coordinator, and it's my pleasure to welcome back Justin Pickens with his series on Wild Brain. So who came yesterday was fascinating, and today it's Where Am I Going? So thank you, Justin.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming today. So I tweaked the title.
Microphone.
I tweaked the title of this talk just a little bit because as I started diving into and pulling together the slides on this, I really ended up focusing a lot on one particular animal for this talk because it's just it's an absolutely fascinating system. So I shifted a little bit more to where am I going as opposed to simply where am I. In general, what we're going to be talking about right now over the next hour is sort of how animals deal with challenges in their environment of trying to figure out where they're going. So what types of and it's basically a story of compasses and maps. The tools that we have as humans that we rely on to figure out where we're going. These become metaphors for our understanding of how animals solve similar challenges in navigation. And so the three main things that we're going to talk about, we're going to discuss a little bit about cues that are available to us to know where we are and to orient ourselves. We're going to dive deep into some research on butterflies. Monarch butterflies and how they figure out which way is south. And then we're going to touch a little bit on mammals and the types of internal maps that we use. So our star of the hour for today is the monarch butterfly. I'm sure everybody's familiar with monarchs. So monarchs are one of the great migrators of North America. So monarch butterflies typically winter fairly far south in Mexico, along the California coast, and Florida. And in the fall, in the springtime, they migrate north to breeding grounds, and then in the winter, migrate back south. And apparently Xerxes Society don't know anything about monarchs in Mexico, which is, I think, a funny thing with this map. they've got all this information on the U.S. and Mexico. It's apparently just a blind spot for them.
No milkweed.
But one of the key constraints on monarchs is the presence of milkweed. So there's a line right here that outlines the northern extent of milkweed. This is necessary for their breeding. The Pacific Northwest up here does not actually have any milkweed available. And one of the interesting challenges here is that monarchs don't live very long. So it's not that the same monarch leaves its wintering ground, goes north, and returns all the way. It takes many generations for these migrations to occur. So any given monarch, in the middle of this migration, is born as a caterpillar and becomes a full monarch butterfly and needs to pick up the migration where its parents left off. And so this the key piece of information here that monarchs need to know basically is which way is south. Like, which way is it that I need to go? So, you're a butterfly. Which way is south? How do you figure out what way south is?
The sun.
The sun. So the sun is a nice clue of which way is south. Where in the northern hemisphere is typically in the south. Changes a little bit during the day, right? Rises in the east, sets in the west. But the sun is a major clue.
Prevailing winds.
Prevailing winds. Yeah. No, because then this is, in general, we're going to have prevailing winds that go west to east more often in the U.S.
Has the magnetosome theory been dissolved?
What's that?
The magnetosomes, are they don't...
Magnetosomes?
Yeah, it was a long, okay.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. With,
it's a while ago that it was a prevalent thought.
Yeah, with monarchs, so birds do have some magnetism, but yes, but magnetism is a major clue, the northwest indicator in general. So the Earth has a magnetic field. This is how our compasses work. So this might be something that's available to animals to identify.
But not monarchs.
As we'll see, not monarchs. Yeah. So what if the sun is very interesting. What if the sun is obscured? What if there's clouds in the sky? What if it's behind a mountain, behind Buckskin Mountain? Is it possible to still know where the sun is, which way is south? It turns out it is. So there's actually a bunch of clues in the sky. And monarchs and other insects rely very heavily on a number of different cues in the sky. So the major one is simply, where is the sun? I look up in the sky and there's a big old bright thing over there, and so that gives me some information about which way is south. There's a bunch of other very interesting patterns that different insects rely on. So nocturnal insects can actually rely on the presence of the Milky Way, which consistently spans east to west in the night sky. There are polarization patterns of skylight that give evidence as to where the sun is, and we'll go into that in a little bit more detail shortly. The sky itself sort of changes in brightness, in its intensity, as you go further away from the sun. But also there's filtering that happens in by virtue of the atmosphere. As you go through the sky, it starts to filter out different colors of the skylight as well. So we can't see it with our eyes, but if you can see in the UV range, you can see a very clear changing of the color of the sky. And then there's actually the Earth's magnetic field itself, which is a clue that different animals can leverage. So do we have any photographers in the audience? Photographers?
Yeah.
We have a photographer up there? Yeah. So can a photographer tell me what's going on with these two pictures?
Well, there's a filter on the right.
There's a filter on the right.
Yeah.
It's a polarizing filter.
Yeah.
So a polarizing filter. So how many of you have like polarized sunglasses? And what do those polarized sunglasses help you do other than spend another $20-$50?
See.
Well, they cut out glare.
They cut out glare, right? So what's interesting is that, so typically, we don't really, I think usually when we think about light, we don't think about the fact that it's a wave. And it's kind of it's a funny kind of wave. I mean, light is a electromagnetic wave that oscillates in multiple directions. So if you have sunlight, unpolarized sunlight coming from the sun, it kind of goes in all directions. So it's got waves going like this, it's got waves going like this, it's got waves going like this, it's got waves going like this. When those waves bounce off of something, so like a molecule in the sky or the water when you're out on a boat, the reflections can end up being polarized. So as this sunlight bounces off this molecule, the reflections that go this way kill, that they deaden the oscillations of the sunlight that are in this direction and leave just the vertical oscillations. Hmm. And so the sunlight that bounces this direction off the molecule maintains kind of a vertical polarization. The sunlight that bounces this way maintains this horizontal polarization. And if you're kind of, the sunlight that kind of comes out at an angle has a little bit of a mixture between these two. And so what this ends up with is that if we have a filter on the lens of our camera that polarizes light, we end up cutting out light that is that goes in the other direction of the polarizing filter, whereas the light that's oscillating in the same direction as our polarizing filter comes through. So if we use a polarizing filter, see this polarizing gradient in the night sky, or in the day, in the sky. And so the way that, what this ends up with is that if we look up, if we have the entire sky and we've got the sun kind of coming from a particular direction, as we go through the sky, the edge of the sky that's kind of the furthest away from the sun ends up with the strongest sense of polarization. And whatever direction that polarizing light is moving, the sun is perpendicular to it. So if I actually am looking at the polarizing filter, all I have to do is look at one little spot in the sky, and I know that the sun is either on this end or the other end of that of the direction of the polarization. So the way that this, so we can kind of see this right here. So if we're early in the morning, if we're this kind of observer down here in the middle, it's early in the morning, the sun is rising and is going to take this path. Early in the morning, there's a strong polarization band that sort of spans from north to south. As the sun reaches, you know, up at the very top at noon, this polarization band is now kind of up in the northern sky. And so this polarization band ends up giving evidence as to where the sun is, even if we can't see the sun. So there's one more kind of complicating factor. So even if we have these clues about where the sun is, we have this fact that our butterfly needs to head south, but you know the sun isn't always in the south. Different times of the day, the sun is pointing in, is either further east or further west. So it's not totally reliable. So we're gonna, does anybody have any ideas on how an animal could face this particular challenge? Yeah?
Watch the sun.
They could watch the sun. Do you think that butterflies know whether it's morning time or night time? They might. So if they paid attention, if they could know whether it was morning time or night time, then they would know where the sun is supposed to be in the sky.
Temperature?
The temperature? Yeah, it might be a temperature gradient during the day that gives some evidence. So there's a few different things that the butterflies can rely on to try to figure out which way is south. You know, where is that bright thing in the sky? What's, you know, how is the color of the sky changing over top of me? How is the polarization of the sky changing? And all this kind of needs to get combined with information about what time of day it is. So here is a zoom in on our creature of the day. So this is the butterfly's eye. This is its main retina. You can see its antennae sticking out up here. And right up here is a little part of the eye. It's called the dorsal rim. It's a little rim of the eye that is highly specialized. So here's our butterfly trying to go south. And this little diagram kind of shows all the information that's available to it. So we've got the sun here. We have all this polarization in the sky that it can look for. And we have this color gradient through the sky that it can see that we can't. And scientists can start to say, okay, well, what is it that the butterflies are actually using by simulating these in the lab? So we can take the butterfly take it into a laboratory environment and use LEDs of different colors to simulate the sun and different colors in the sky. And also take a UV LED, shine it through a polarizer up above the butterfly in order to see whether the butterfly pays attention to the polarization of the light and whether they rely on this as a cue. Scientists have done this. So in this first, there's going to be four little videos here. So in the first video, we have a butterfly that's kind of affixed to a little rotating thing, so it can fly around, but it kind of stays in place. And it's inside of a cylinder so that it can't see the actual sun, and the camera is facing up, looking up from below, and we have the sky light coming in from the outside. And then we have a little polarizing filter right here. And so in this first little clip, the polarizing filter is parallel to the skylight. And so our butterfly flies in one direction. And then they shift that filter. They turn the filter, and the butterfly turns as well. If they completely block out UV and completely get rid of any polarization, and the butterfly is just kind of scattering around. It doesn't have any reference to what the polarization is. And so it now has no idea which way is south, which way it should be flying. And then as they return get rid of the UV interference filter, what was blocking out the UV, and return to the polarizing filter, then the butterfly can fly in its direction. And so it turns out that not only that butterflies rely on that this upper edge, this dorsal rim right here, is completely separate actually from the rest of the eye. I mean, it's right next to it, but it has a totally different set of cells, that are sensitive very specifically to polarized light, to polarized sunlight. And the neural connections from this part of the eye go to a different portion of the brain than the neurons that are coming from the main retina. So butterflies aren't the only insects with these specialties for polarization. Honeybees and bumblebees have this as well as desert locusts. Both of which have been actually studied much more than monarch butterflies. And so scientists have actually been able to trace the very specific sets of connections that go from the dorsal rim into specialized nuclei, specialized parts of the butterfly brain. Oh, sorry. These are 3D mock-ups of the brains of honeybee and the brains of the desert locust. And so there are these specialized connections that come in into the brain and into this little central area down here that's in green, that's called the central complex. And for the desert locust, the where things are a little bit different. So, you know, where this area that the DRNE is a little bit different in the desert locust versus the bumblebee. But it's the same sets of connections and the same sets of regions, even though the shapes of things are a little bit different between the animals.
Justin, another question.
Yeah.
Do they kind of fly all together in formation? Like, okay, now we're going to fly, folks. We're going a distance, and then maybe we'll stop for lunch on these bushes. And then we'll fly. Or are they just kind of bopping from bush to bush? And at the end of the day, they've actually made some progress south.
Yeah, I don't know, actually. I don't know the ecology very well. Does anybody else know more about monarch ecology than I do? Yeah, I mean, I think that when... Yeah, I'm not sure.
Do they fly at night? Or do they eat and sleep at night and fly in the daytime?
I think the monarchs usually fly during the daytime. Yeah, there's a few other... We'll touch on some other insects that are nighttime migrators. But the monarchs are mostly during the day.
Don't they gravitate to one place in Mexico?
Yeah, there's a couple of specific areas in Mexico that are like prime monitoring grounds.
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah.
So you had said that there were, and I mean, this is the ecology of it, so you might not know this answer, but that they fly north, like it takes generations to get to mm-hmm. Mexico. But sometimes then they have to know that they gotta be flying north.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, so some they have to figure right. a lot of things out, right? They have to decide, am I going north or am I going south this time?
Yeah. yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And I don't remember what the
I just wanted to think about that. I wanted to make sure I didn't miss that.
No. I don't know. You didn't miss that. No. There's a northward journey as well.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
And they would, I mean, presumably they'd use similar cues, except that they'd have decided that they're following the different lights and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They have to at some point know which way they're supposed to go, whether it's north or south.
Right.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
I did monarch butterfly tagging in, they do eat nectar in Goleta, and what I remember is a lot of this stuff we still don't know and are still trying to figure out. The way it would work, I worked with a gentleman whose name escapes me, you might know who he is, with Santa Monica Community Colleges. We would put like little stickers on their wings, and then if anybody found the carcass, they were supposed to alert the department. So, and then as to when the timing is going to be, and yeah, multi-generational aspect. So what I came away from it was just, again, a lot of this stuff we're still trying to figure out. A lot of it, we didn't have the technology.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Even 10 years ago.
Right, yeah.
So.
Yeah. So this is one of the reasons. So this is, and I think one of what's interesting with, this body of research, kind of where I came about it is when it, I was trained as a neuroscientist, and this was sort of this. I came across this body of research when scientists started, particularly a couple of researchers who had done a lot of work in the desert locust, which is the locust of Moses' fame in Egypt and Africa. So these are migratory as well, and there's been a lot of research done on the desert locust spring. And basically those researchers started looking towards the monarch butterflies to say, okay, how much is similar here? What's different? You know, can we start to see where the commonalities are? And I'll touch on that here shortly. But I think one of the interesting things with a lot of certainly with a lot of neuroscience research is that once you start, as a researcher, once you start kind of making traction and starting to understand a particular animal really well, it's very easy to kind of keep going down that hole, because every, one of my favorite books is Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert Pirsig, and there's a quote in there that for every fact there's an infinity of hypotheses, right? Like every new thing that you learn just begets more and more questions that you want to follow up on. And so this body of research I think is particularly interesting because by virtue of all the work that had been done in the desert locust, they were able to kind of get up to speed on a lot of the neuroscience of the monarch very quickly by making those comparisons. And so to kind of zoom in on this, so this area, the central complex is kind of where all of these, where the polarization signals come in, as well as other cues of light and migration. And they've basically been able to identify these commonalities between the structures in the brain of the desert locust, as well as the monarch butterfly, dung beetles, which also have a fascinating set of navigation challenges that they face. And these bees from South America called sweat bees, which I actually had heard much about until I came across this paper, but they are some bees that are nocturnal, so they have much better eyesight than most honeybees, but kind of a similar set of brain regions, and they've got kind of dotted lines right here because it's purely speculative that they're pretty sure that these brain regions also exist in the sweat bees, even though they haven't been.
Do they live in the ground?
The sweat bees?
Do they live? Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know anything about sweat bees. So, the monarch butterfly, though, as it turns out, that if you go through and try to actually kind of carefully trace a bunch of these connections and these connections between these the different brain regions, it actually maps on very closely and very similarly to the desert locust. One thing that neuroscientists who work with insects are able to do is actually very specifically label certain cells. Like there are certain cells in the brain that have these known names, and they're very recognizable by their structure. These researchers were able to go through and identify known cells in locusts, which are in black, and find a homologue cell in the monarchs in gray here. And then each of these columns is a different brain region. So this cell, you know, Tulal 1 projects from this region to this region, and there's a homolog in the monarch as well. And except for a couple of, you know, kind of a couple of differences between the locus and the butterflies, they appear to have a very, very similar structure in their brain for these polarization circuitry. This is particularly striking because the monarch's butterflies, like their line and evolutionary line and the evolutionary line of the desert locust, diverged 350 million years ago. So, I mean, dinosaurs, we're talking like, you know, went extinct 65 million years ago. So we're talking, you know, common circuitry, common neural structures that go, are way older than even the dinosaurs. And so for these monarch butterflies, as we noted, you know, early on, the sun position is kind of the dominant cue that they rely on. And this comes in and comes into their eye through the main retina. The different spectral gradients, the different colors of the sky that they can also use as a clue as to where the sun is, comes in through the main retina as well. They get polarization information through this dorsal rim. And so all of this information basically gives them a sense of where the sun is. We still need to figure out what way is south. And it turns out that in the same way that we have a circadian rhythm, we have our own cycle through our day, that we get sleepy at night, we wake up in the morning, our hormones change and drift and kind of carry us through a daily rhythm, that monarchs have a similar circadian rhythm. However, theirs actually comes from their antennae. So the antenna itself is what maintains the circadian rhythm and is trained by the sunlight. So the cycle of sunlight over the day, the, you know, 12 hours of light, 12 hours of dark, plus or minus, depending on what time of year you're in, this entrains the antennae to go through a 24-hour cycle every day in its activity. And if you take the antenna off of the butterfly, it keeps going through this cycle. And scientists can mess with the light and show that it's the light that is entraining this cycle for the antennae. So the antenna is maintaining this kind of 24-hour clock at the same time that the animal is able to pull in all these cues from the sky and merge this information and basically use this information that's coming from the antenna in order to calibrate that sun compass so that early in the morning it, you know, bears a little bit right of the location of the sun. And then as the antenna's activity kind of shifts towards the midday point, then it starts bearing towards the sun, and as it shifts towards the afternoon, it bears a little bit left of the sun.
Justin, is there a brain that coordinates this? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is all of this information gets merged together in sort of this central portion of the butterfly's brain. Yeah. And there's it's a combination of work that's active work right now to understand what exactly the connections are to do recordings of different neurons within the brain as they get exposed to different light cycles and different polarization in order to understand the function of individual neurons within the brains. And then a fair bit of computational modeling in order to model how it is that a bunch of neurons merge all this information together in order to maintain this compass calibration. But yes, it's all happening in these little tiny brains. I had some colleagues who do work with fruit flies, which are even smaller than monarchs, and actually do have, you know, in order to do this kind of research, you have to be able to do, you know, very surgeries under microscopes in order to open up, you know, the part of the head to get down into the brain in order to understand and do these types of recordings. And it's very challenging work to do.
Has anybody gone with this information the other direction, like towards birds?
That's a good question. Yeah, I don't know. I think that, yeah, because we were chatting about birds earlier. I'm not sure, I don't know very much about bird migratory behavior. I know that that certainly for pigeons and for a couple of birds, I think it's pretty clear that they are relying on magnetic cues. There are some certain, there's like one region in the brain that they've identified as having cells that are sensitive to magnetic fields. But where the birds are, like what the sensors are that they can get that information from isn't totally clear. And the last I heard, there were basically two candidates. One was like certain cells in the beak. And the other were actual cells in the retina. And which of these two were able to actually pick up the magnetic cues wasn't totally clear. So kind of what we've been talking about so far has been, you know, this sort of long distance migration that monarchs engage in. You know, they have this genetically fixed migratory heading, you know, based on their, you know, that they go south, they go north, right? They go one way. There are other insects kind of deal with different challenges in their environment in different ways. So over here on the left is our a dung beetle. Dung beetles go through an interesting in kind of moving the dung around to get back to their home. They're largely nocturnal. And they basically kind of take a snapshot of the night sky and memorize it. And they memorize what the sky looks like. They go out and as they're heading back to their home, you know, pushing this pile of poop around, they, you know, will turn, climb up on top of the dung. And look to the sky, kind of move around, figure out where their bearing is, drop back down, and then resume their direction.
What if it's cloudy?
I don't know. I'm not sure what that. Well, they actually. So, yeah, I don't know. They rely on they have polarization as well. So I don't know if they can get some like polarization from the moon or something like this. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's important to note though that even though, you know, that a lot of what these insects are doing is, I think, very similar to what we do in our own lives, is that we actually rely on a lot of different information at the same time. So even if these insects have like something specialized for polarized light, you know, they're trading off and they're kind of balancing different cues that might be competing, might be not necessarily entirely consistent with one another. And so they're integrating a lot of information in order to make their decisions as well.
Have you guys seen the videos where they put the dung beetles in, what do you call it, where you look at the night sky indoors at the Science Museum?
Oh.
Planetarium.
Yeah, they put dung beetles in a planetarium. It's cute.
And then there's a number of ants that kind of do some very similar, some very interesting. Where rather than kind of looking at the night sky, they look for cues in the distance and kind of memorize the profile of distant cues. And then as they are navigating towards, you know, back to their nest, they're trying to make sure that the distant image is corresponding to what their memory was. And they can also navigate based on individual landmarks as well. So if there's a very specific landmark that they're referencing. And again, this is, you know, most of these animals are kind of using different pieces of this at the same time. So I think that, you know, one of the really striking things to me about sort of this body of research is just how you know, this cue from the night sky, or from the day sky, that, you know, until you started throwing polarized filters on camera lenses, is like completely, we're just completely oblivious to, is an incredibly important cue for them. So important that for over 350 million years, they've had a specialized portion of their eye that's sensitive to these cues, and that the neural structures that are in place, despite, you know, massive divergence in these insects and in what they're pursuing, that these structures are very old and are conserved and common between them. So what about us? So what are the maps that we hold in our heads? So one of I don't know. So tell me how do you know? How do you have a sense of whether you are in the cafeteria, in the hotel, versus in the pool hall?
First day I didn't know where I was.
You learn something, right?
You explore.
Your vision.
You explore.
Yeah, cues from the environment.
Mm-hmm. So I suspect that when I started asking this from you too, you guys probably started having some memories of being in those spaces, right? Mm-hmm. You started reflecting a little bit on like, what does, what is it like? What is it like to be in the cafeteria, right? What is it like to be in this place? I suspect that you probably, maybe there were very specific events over the last few days or over the last, many years, if it's been a long time since you've come back to Holden, that are very tightly intertwined with your sense of place and with your sense of
memory. Space. Is that what you're
doing? Your memory, these memories. Yeah.
Partly also it's a sense of smell. Mm-hmm. Smell bread baking, you smell the laundry. I mean, there are some things like that, or I smell coffee. I know in the dining hall is because I can smell coffee.
Yep, totally.
Which is important.
So, we rely, we rely on a lot of different sensory cues to give us ourselves a sense of space. And I think that we have a little bit of an intuition that this is tightly locked to our memories and our memory system. So in humans, one of the interesting things, in humans and in mice, so we have this part of our brain that's called the hippocampus. Does anybody know what the hippocampus does? You heard of the hippocampus before?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I should know. It's your memory, isn't it?
Memory. So the hippocampus has been known for a very long time to be core and central to establishing long-term memories. So in humans, it's kind of, it's not on the, this makes it look like it's on the outside of the brain. It's kind of buried inside of the brain, down here. Does anybody have a sense of what the etymology is of this word?
Horse college.
Horse what? Horse college?
Well, campus means.
So this horse.
Field, right, or.
Yeah. So we're the probably like horse region, I think is or something along those lines. So the reason that this area is named that, it's very hard to see in different slices of the brain, but the actual physical structure, the early neurologist who identified it thought that it was shaped like a seahorse.
Huh. Oh.
So that's how it got its name.
Huh.
So this seahorse structure, there is a very sad tale of a patient who was dealing with terrible epilepsy, and they removed both sides of his brain. Whoa. Including his hippocampus. This guy's name was Henry Molaison, H.M. Patient H.M. He died a few years ago, so for many decades, he was just known in the neuroscience and neurology literature as patient HM. But when he passed away, he was de-identified, and his family agreed to have his name more widely known. So he went through a surgery to deal with epilepsy, removing both sides of his hippocampus, and he was no longer able to form new memories. Completely unable to form new memories. Incredibly tragic. I feel like the history of neuroscience is actually just like tragedy after tragedy. Mm-hmm. I remember in college or in graduate school, we had this lecture. I can't remember who it was, but it was a neurologist who argued that the single most influential invention on modern neuroscience was the high-powered rifle, because it. Starting with World War I, people could end up having brain damage in war and survive. So once we started having various traumas that selectively injured different parts of the brain, that gives us a lot of information about what those parts of the brain do. So the hippocampus has, for a very, very long time, been known to be important for memory. And so researchers back in the 70s started trying to understand how memories worked in rats, where we could actually do recordings within the hippocampus and actually put rats in mazes in kind of a classic sense. And when they started doing this, they started discovering these cells that would respond in very specific portions of the animal's environment. Along a track, the animal kind of going through a maze or exploring like a little miniature field, like a large box. That there would be cells that would, in the hippocampus, that would only fire at certain portions of that of the area. And these became known as place cells. And they become known as place cells because what we have here is the animal was running around exploring an area, like a 1 meter by 1 meter square area. And so all these black lines is the path that it took as it was exploring. And all these red spots are individual locations that this particular cell in the hippocampus had a spike that it fired. And so these cells ended up kind of clustered. For this particular cell, it tends to fire right around here. And so we can kind of create a map of like what portions of the field is the cell most likely to respond. And it's most likely to respond kind of in this area. And these cells, and so within the mouse or within the rat's brain, it will have multiple place cells. So as if the researcher has recorded and has recorded from lots of different cells in the brain, there might be this place cell, there might be one that's specific right here, one that's specific right here, one that's specific to kind of over here on this edge. And so there's kind of these place cells that are kind of specific to the environment that the animal is in. There's another set of cells that is in the entorhinal cortex that connects to the hippocampus that has cells that have kind of a different set of characteristics. So rather than only responding in one part of the space that the animal is in, they fire repeatedly in something of sort of a grid. So in sort of this grid fashion, they fire right here, they fire right here, they fire right here, they fire right here, they fire right here. So they end up with this kind of pattern over the space. And this cell will have this particular pattern. So this is one cell that responds in multiple locations. And a different cell will have a slightly shifted pattern. And a different cell will have a shifted pattern from that one. And for grid cells, they're consistently in these kind of octagonal grids. They're in these kind of 6x6 or 3x3 equilateral triangles is sort of the structure of their grids. which is a very efficient way to kind of compactly represent space. And so the last few years of research have pointed to is that basically these cells end up forming kind of the foundation of our internal spatial maps that we rely on in order to form memories. So these cells can be end up being very contextual. We talked a little bit about you know, smell as a context, visual cues, like different environmental cues that we have as a context. So in this experiment, the rat was in a circular field, has a place cell that kind of responds in these two spots right here. I think there's like a white card up on the wall. And when they swap that white card out with a black card, now the place cell has a different response. This has become like a new place to that particular cell. There's a new context. And if they switch the white card back out, then the position shifts again. Similar work going from a square field to a circular field and then back to a square field shows similar things happening in grid cells. So this grid cell has a particular pattern that it responds to. When it's in the circular field, it has a different pattern, a different set of space that it corresponds to. And when the rat is put back into the gridded field, it goes back and kind of remaps to its original location. And by comparing this square with this square, that's what we have right here, and this kind of hot spot right in the middle here gives us a clue and tells us that this grid is effectively the same as this grid, but the blue grid is different, and it's offset. And one of the things that's interesting with the grid cells is that grid cells, these changes, when you shift between environments, if I have three grid cells that I've recorded at the same time and change the environment, the shift in the grid cells is the same across all of the grid cells. So the grid cells will all shift together into a new environment, but the place cells, when they do these kinds of switches, don't do that. The place cells end up having completely novel locations. And so there's a lot of active research happening right now to try to understand exactly how these things map out. But the basic idea is that these grid cells sort of form this basis, they form this structure of these of the map of the world that then other cues integrate in order to emerge and get these locations of individual place fields. And it's the combination of all of these place cells together that establish this sense of space and this sense of location and this sense of context that then get tightly intertwined with our long-term memory system. So I'm sorry, that's very hand-wavy. But this is sort of what is currently known and kind of the our current understanding of how mammalian spatial cues come together. So our key takeaways for today is that our monarch butterflies have this internal sun compass and are kind of pulling from a lot of different cues in the sky, including polarization, to help them know where the sun is, even when it's obscure. Their antennae maintain this time of day clock, and the circuitry to merge this information and to pull this information into the brain seems to be shared with lots of insects. And that we, rats and mammals, maintain spatial maps in our hippocampus that are integral to our sense of place and the formation of our own long-term memories. So thank you very much for joining us.